Majors & Quinn presents
Sloan Crosley.
Sloan Crosley is the author of the New York Times bestsellers I Was Told There'd Be Cake, a Thurber Prize finalist, and How Did You Get This Number?, as well as her most recent book, which just came out in paperback called The Clasp. I finished it this week, and it's really amazing. And I'm not just saying that because I work here. If you don't have your copy yet and you're just here kind of like for fun, but you're on the fence about getting a book, I really recommend it. She is also a frequent contributor to the New York Times and now lives in Manhattan. And this is her first time here in the bookstore in Majors & Quinn. So an even extra welcome. So tonight's event is sponsored by The Riveter magazine. The Riveter is a long-form women's lifestyle magazine based here in Minneapolis. And we are joined tonight by two of their staff members who will be discussing the book with Sloan after her reading. So Kaylin Ralph, the blonde, is the Riveter's co-founder, editorial development director, and brand director. Johanna Demkovich, the brunette, is the Riveter's editorial director and co-founder as well. The Riveter is, so Kaylin also works at the Anthropology store at West End, and the Riveter and Anthropology are working together. She is starting a book club. And at that store. And the first one will be Wednesday, June 22nd. And guess what they're reading? They're reading The Clasp by Sloan Crosley. So now, please join me in welcoming Kaylin Ralph, Jana Demkovich, and Sloan Crosley.
Thank you, everyone, so much for coming out. And thank you to Majors & Quinn and to The Riveter for hosting this event or co-hosting it, and for your general enthusiasm and support for this book, and all of you for just, on a superficial note, just looking really lovely. Just everyone just looks really nice. I've been traveling, I don't know. Before I begin, actually, I don't need to give you much of a preamble because I'm going to read from the very beginning of The Clasp. So if it needed too much of an explanation, I'd be in trouble for larger reasons. So this is the prelude. At first, they watched the rain from inside the tent, and then they watched it come inside the tent. A stone path extended from the house to the shore. When the shuttle buses arrived, the stones were opaque. Now they were translucent. The kind of wet that made it difficult to imagine them ever being dry again. Lightning struck the surface of the ocean, and a curtain of hot wind swayed inward at their feet, pushing detached bouquet petals in a row. Victor took a step back. These were his only nice shoes. Victor had never been on a private island before, which was not shocking, but he had also never been to Florida before, which was a little shocking. True, he was a poorly traveled person, but still, Disney World, spring break, other people's grandparents. Florida had simply slipped through the cracks of his adulthood, like an idiom heard too late. He was under the impression that the rain here was supposed to be extreme but brief, the opposite of, say, Seattle, a place he hadn't been to either. But this was a monsoon. The groomsmen's jackets had come off. The women had grown shorter over the course of the evening. Everyone was buzzed. What time was it, 10 p.m.? Too early to be drunk in real life, but right on schedule for Carolyn Markson's wedding. He heard her cackle in the distance and turned back to face the ocean, letting his mind drift. He was dubious of his environs. Florida, rather the stretch of it he had witnessed from the airport, causeways and condominiums, sunrise liquor and sunset dental, bank branches surrounded by menacing palmetto plants, was trying to trick him into thinking it was a real place. A place where people rode school buses and purchased paper towel in bulk. His table mates took one look at Victor's chowder-fed skin and launched into stories of art and literary fairs, of this country club or that being very, quote, old Florida. But Victor knew from old. He grew up in Massachusetts, home to America's oldest ballpark, strictest landmark laws, and most famous horseback ride. Florida was pretty colonized come lately by comparison. Even the old people here felt new. Victor's parents were in their 60s, but their actual 60s, not their fake 40s. His mother, a substitute teacher, would no longer, quote, do stairs, and was increasingly vigilant about her Raynauds. His father, a land surveyor, had given him a $100 bill and a bottle of You Bet chocolate syrup when he moved to Park Slope with Nathaniel after graduation. This was before Nathaniel fled to Los Angeles, swapping his literary aspirations for centered dialogue. Now Victor lived alone in an alcove studio in Sunset Park. I think you stole my balls. Victor had returned to his seat to assess the damage to his shoes and found a thick-necked man gripping to a dinner roll as if he had freshly yanked it from the chest cavity of a buffalo. The man pointed at a dish of butter balls. Oh, said Victor, I did. Sorry, I went left. You can have mine. I think this one has rosemary in it, and this one has sea salt, Himalayan sea salt. Sounds good, Victor said. I despise rosemary, said the man. Carolyn had arranged the rest of their collegiate circle around a table clear across the dance floor. Victor was momentarily buoyed by the idea that this was an act of faith, suggesting that he was harmless, nay, charming, when foisted upon strangers. Unfortunately, these thoughts were immediately anchored by knowing that it was an act of acquiescence. Carolyn felt obliged to invite him. He couldn't be the only one she left out. Out of some kind of misplaced retaliation, he hadn't touched his main course. This put him in a standoff with the catering staff, who, out of their own misplaced retaliation, had yet to remove his plate. From this vantage point, he could see Nathaniel whispering in Kezia's ear. Nathaniel's jawline had become strangely defined these past few years. It made Victor touch his own jaw to see if jaws were that much of a separate entity on everyone. These days, Nathaniel was also dressing better. Foppish, that was the word, wasn't it? Fucktard, that was the other one. His friend had become both of these things. They barely spoke anymore, forcing Victor to make a choice. Be a needy girl about it or ignore it. He chose the latter, but right this second, there was something blocking his path of disregard. Kezia's mouth was so close to Nathaniel's that if she turned, their lips would touch. Her head was bent, chin tucked, listening raptly. She flipped a fork against the tablecloth, as if concentrating on the fork was the only thing keeping her from falling off the chair. No tux for you? The thick-necked man chewed with his mouth open. I couldn't afford it, said Victor. Every self-respecting young man should have a tux. Well, Victor lifted his glass, that explains why I don't have one. Where did you say you lived in New York? Brooklyn, said Victor. Brooklyn Heights is nice. That it is. And how did you make the acquaintance of the bride? We went to college together, said Victor, the group of us. He gestured around the tent, even though he wasn't sure where anyone was. Kezia and Nathaniel had gotten up. The fork had stayed behind. Ah, so you've known each other since you were babies. A sharp memory came to Victor. That night, freshman year, when he managed to bring Carolyn Markson back to his dorm room. When Victor reached between her legs, she hopped off the bed, bent down like a baboon, and showed him her tampon string. Proof for prudeness. Still, he wished his roommates had been conscious. Victor didn't bring many girls home. He was not an attractive guy, he got that. He was wiry and he hunched. His face was horsey but not equine, olive but not Mediterranean. Though on two separate occasions he'd been told he bore a resemblance to the sharp-faced actor Adrian Brody. But he was beginning to think there would not be a third occasion. And you and Carolyn went to a co-ed school? Asked the man. Victor looked at him. Yes, we did. Ginny, my wife, went to one of those glorified lesbian communes. Some all-girls place that should have gone co-ed but didn't. Practically bankrupt now. Always some third-rate yoga instructor on the cover of the alumni magazine. Victor listened as best as he could. He was usually okay with being a receptacle for such gripes. It was all feeding a beast that never went hungry anyway, a beast of casual disdain for the wealthy, a socialist tapeworm in his gut that snacked on morsels of humidor and meditation retreat. But enough was enough. Excuse me, Victor put his napkin in his chair. I'm going to watch the storm. You can't see it from here? Asked the man. I need new ones of these. Victor pushed his glasses up the Sisyphean slope of his nose. The man tightened a cufflink, which put a sprightly spotlight on the wine glasses. Ginny materialized behind them, all smiles and cleavage and lighthearted scolding for, quote, holding this young man captive. So nice to meet you, she said, even though they had not. As Victor squished his way towards the edge of the tent, he spotted Olivia Arellano standing beneath a flickering lantern. God, Olivia Arellano. He thought he had glimpsed the back of her head during the ceremony. Pickled in rum and venom, Olivia looked the same every time he had seen her over the past decade, always wearing the same Olivia uniform. As Kezia once astutely pointed out, you know that girl owns 20 black sweaters as opposed to one frequently recycled black sweater. The last time Victor had even seen her name was a year ago, when Paul Stephenson and Gray Kelly, keepers of the collegiate ideal, newlyweds, and chief bangers of the networking drum, had organized a gathering because it had been too long. Gang, began the email from Paul. It's been way too long. Who's to say? Who decides? And what heterosexual man uses so many vowels? The email was also signed from Gray, as if she had typed her own name. They were like children taking turns on an outgoing voicemail. The chumminess of the invite only slightly undermined by a block of text deeming the contents confidential bank correspondence. Victor skipped drinks. How a girl like Olivia Arellano had heard of a tiny liberal arts school in New England, never mind applied to it, never mind heard of New England, confounded him to this day. He and Olivia had never been close, and they never would be. Yet even she was tied to him. Olivia Arellano was the first person he met. She struck up a conversation with him while they waited at campus security for their respective room keys. Fresh off a plane from Caracas, she carried a peeling leather trunk that looked as if it contained human bones, and asked him questions like, "Do you think the next 4 years will be stimulating, or do you think we will liken them to jail?" He had no idea what she was talking about, but her boobs were up to her neck. Olivia was a false advertisement for what college women would be like, a false advertisement for herself, even. She was studying him, peppering him with questions, not to befriend him, but to determine if he was like her, sophisticado. He was not. He had just come from a house with aluminum siding in Sudbury, Massachusetts. He didn't have a passport. His jackets were North Face, his storage bins Bed Bath & Beyond, his mother a Law & Order SVU fan. They accepted their respective keys and headed for separate ends of campus. He watched her glide up the gentle slope of a path, one of the many that would become as familiar as the veins in the back of his hand. And even now, a decade later, he could remember that freshman-specific sensation, like he'd know this girl for the rest of her life and like he'd never see her again. Turns out both hunches were right. That conversation was the longest he would have with Olivia for a solid year. He saw her, sure, everyone saw everyone. But Olivia did her dating off campus, shunning any man who could be accessed via a 4-digit extension. She elected alternative housing, slept with professors, and refused to eat in the dining hall, all before losing the revolt and settling down their junior year. Half of their class went abroad, but Olivia stayed because she was abroad already. She melded herself into Victor's circle of friends like a blob of mercury, absorbed by the girls, lady advocates who saw some invisible wound in need of tending when they looked at her. Or maybe they saw just another pretty face to squeeze into their photos. He didn't care about their motivations, not really. Olivia Arellano was never the primary object of his affections. That title belonged to someone else. And by their final semester, none of it mattered. By then, Victor was allowing himself to fantasize about Kezia's face only in profile, never indulging in the dead-on view. By then, he was supposed to have forgiven her for cruelly rejecting his love. Not just forgiven, erased. To forgive was to be in conversation with the past, and, well, they couldn't have that, now could they? Caps and gowns had been ordered, resumes sent out, mailbox keys returned. It was in poor taste to acknowledge that college had been anything other than a coming-of-age paradise. By then, they all had 1 foot out the door, and Victor had gotten himself a passport with a lone Canadian stamp in the middle. Dead grandfather in Toronto. Thanks.
Thank you.
So that's the beginning, which sets up a love triangle between Kezia, Victor, and Nathaniel, who are all mentioned, although that is obviously Victor's point of view. He's a bit sad. Yeah.
Great. Well, Yana and I have a few questions prepared for Sloan, and then we're going to open up the floor to y'all. So definitely keep your questions ready for the end.
Keep them close to the vest.
Yep, close to the vest. Hopefully there's not too many repeats. So you, in interviews and in general, have been pretty open about the fact that it took you about 5 years to write and publish The Clasp, though of course you continue to write what I would call prolifically in the interim for different magazines and newspapers. So as an essayist, journalist, and novelist, how do you decide when and how to harness like the separate energies it takes to cross between mediums? How do you control the back and forth and keep your voice authentic across those different platforms? Deadlines aside, because of course deadlines are a pretty powerful motivator. but if you're having a bad day, hopefully. but if you're having a bad day, but you have to write, what type do you turn to first?
Oh, wow. Okay. That is a good question.
It might have been several in one. I apologize.
No, it's fine. It's good. Well, I also, it's actually a lovely question. The only issue with it is that I was told to repeat it. No.
Wait a second. But the gist we don't need to repeat it.
We don't?
We just need to repeat audience questions.
Okay, we need to repeat audience questions.
You're good.
Oh,
you're good.
Sorry. Okay. I was trying to memorize it as you were speaking, and I'm like, all my energy is being harnessed to memorize the question. well, there's a great, I mean, you know, aside from deadlines, there is the great Dorothy Parker quote is when someone asked her, you know, why she writes, and she said, "For want of money, dear," which is not a very artistic quote, but she could get away with saying it because she did so many other wonderful things and said so many other wonderful things. I think that, you know, I quit my job. I'd worked for Random House full time, and I quit my job to write the book, not really knowing how long it would take, but just knowing that I had tried. I'd sort of taken a couple of shots at writing fiction while I was working, and I found that I just couldn't sustain it. I had to sort of go into my own world to do it, whereas with nonfiction, I think actually bouncing off the world and having other responsibilities is incredibly helpful because it's so, at least narrative nonfiction, is so purely observation-based. And so that was sort of helpful for that. But so to write them both, now, I tend to write fiction in the morning. It's when my head is the most clear. It's also when I've thought of something, you know, just before bed that will contribute to it. And then I write nonfiction in the afternoon. I mean, this is also assuming, I mean, we're talking about the ideal productive day here. We're talking about a day in which, you know.
Every day?
Right. Well, be every day. I'm not Joyce Carol Oates. I'm not writing right now as you're listening to this.
A perfect 65.
Right. But exactly. It's also great.
Yeah.
My perfect day is April 15th. No, it's more that I you can't, after a while you do damage to whatever you're writing if you keep on writing, which is actually a strange awakening from having a day job where it's sort of conceivable you could never stop working. You know, the kind of job I had, I did publicity for other authors, and there's never enough, even if you think there is. So, but you actually will start, I feel like, doing your own writing harm and your own brain harm if you write for, you know, 8 hours in a row, unless you're on like one of those rare, for me, it's like a biannual jag. Some people do it all the time. I don't know if they have the help of opiates. I don't know what what happens. But so I tend to write until about lunch. And then I do things that I have to do that are more immediate deadlines in the afternoon. Because that, as you said, that provides the outside motivator, where in the morning it has to come from inside the house.
Yeah.
Is that a long, boring answer to the question?
No, that's
okay.
It was not boring. I kind of want to talk about the characters. So we just heard the prelude, which is from Victor's perspective. And I think I wrote this down. I don't have to read it verbatim, but I think in a Vogue, it was a Vogue interview when the hardcover was released. You talked about how you actually got to know Kezia, the lone woman, identifying character in the book. Last, I think, is what you said. I don't want to put words into your mouth, but and I
make it seem like I lied to Vogue.
Was this quote accurate? Are they ever? Anyway, we're journalists. I kind of want to talk about so the Riveter. We work with women identified writers, and so I'm constantly thinking about how women engage with one another. And then I read that quote, and then it made me kind of wonder how you engaged with Kezia, and how it was that you came to know her last, or maybe after Victor and Nathaniel, two very opposite but masculine characters. I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, I'm going to back it up one slight sort of like a housekeeping step, which is it's explained. It's actually not explained in the book. It's explained in the acknowledgments. Oops. But her name, which probably sounds a little strange, comes from a Catherine Mansfield short story. That's one of my favorites. It's really wonderful. And it's the book in a lot of ways becomes a tribute to the short story. Maybe we'll talk about it. Maybe we won't. But either way, that's why she has this sort of funky name. And then Victor... just in terms of, since we're talking about all the characters anyway, Victor is meant to be ironic because he's the last thing from Victorious. Mm-hmm. And Nathaniel means gift from God because that's what he sort of thinks he is. Yeah. So that's they all have sort of their own light meaning. But anyway, so what happened was is Victor's voice came first. Mm-hmm. And in a weird way, if I can be sort of critical about my own, I don't know if this is the forum to be, I mean, I'm supposed to be selling this thing to you guys, but if I can be critical about my own book, in a way, I feel like the novel sometimes doesn't get away from him because he did come first, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it is supposed to be a love triangle between the three of them. So Victor, I feel like I got to know so well. And right after this doesn't spoil too much because it happens immediately after the passage I read. He gets fired from his job. And what's funny is I quit my job voluntarily when I started writing this book, but some of those observations were, they overlap. Like when he only knows it's raining outside because his mail is wet because he's been inside all day. Like that's personal experience where he's like, wow, I'm really plowing through toilet paper now that I'm not in an office building all day. Like that's me. You know, so that's not good. But so my heart went out to him because it was sort of directly connected to him at that time. And then it's not so much that I got to know. I knew, actually, Kezia first. It was going to be just the two of them. And then both of them in their own ways were obsessed with Nathaniel. And so Nathaniel kind of wouldn't shut up. And he became, you know, crappy people are really fun to write. And especially if they can have a little bit of redemption, which hopefully he does. But so it's not so much that I got to the order I got to know them. I think what I meant when I said that was that I felt like I wasn't always on her side. Mm-hmm. I just so felt like this girl had sort of flippantly rejected our hero's love. And I thought I would be. I mean, I thought, honestly, writing two collections of personal essays were the most common word is I. You know, I thought that would transfer over and my sympathies would be most automatically with her. But she took a while because she actually is quite different from me, and now she's my favorite.
Yeah.
Just slow burn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you segued perfectly, better than we could have even set up the segue to the next question.
Something about burning.
Which, yeah. We were like, let's anticipate her responses. Yes. So you're speaking specifically to the bridge between your personal essays, of which you've written two volumes of them before the clasp. I was actually going to ask specifically for, and I'm like, keep gesturing to it, so I'll just hold it, but this is our first collection. It's very well thumbed through. Oh yeah, you want to hold it up? Yeah. But there's an essay in this collection that at the time that I was reading it in college was like, you know, my mantra, the Ursula cookie, when you talk about your first job where you were an assistant to a rather domineering, unpredictable publisher. Yeah. And I saw that relationship reflected between Kezia and Rachel, her boss. So I was wondering whether you could speak to, and you kind of already answered it, you don't really identify with her. I was going to ask if she was somehow autobiographical, but on that note, where do you see yourself coming through from the characters? Because I'm sure with a personal essay background, that had to come through somebody. Right. So who was your, like, oracle?
Thanks for being such a good reader, first of all.
I'm a super fan.
No, that's very, very well spotted. Thank you. So I think that it's interesting. The first boss I had, so the essay that she's referring to, I kept trying to please this boss I had that was sort of impossible to please, and she thought I was a horrible assistant, and I actually wasn't. But the more she thought I was, the worse I became, which is not really, I don't think you should have like carrots dangled in front of you. You don't need a gold star. We're all grown-ups. But in an effort to get back into her favor, I one night really late baked a bunch of cookies because I'm a big baker, and I baked one in the shape of her head and gave it to her, which seemed like an excellent idea at the time. Ingratiate yourself 101.
Was it just her head or
it was
also
just
her face?
Head.
Okay.
I mean, well, oh yeah. Was it the back of her head? No. I mean, that would be, it wasn't like a 3D
shape
cookie.
Of her head
it wasn't
plated.
Oh yeah, the eyes, the lips. Do you guys know what fondant icing is? We can have a whole other conversation about fondant icing for another time. But anyway, so it was this effort, and it went really poorly, and there was nothing I could do, and she was always snapping at me. And once I sent something out, FedEx instead of UPS, and she said, she pulled me into her office and said, maybe publishing isn't for us. But what's weird is it's slightly reflected. There's a relationship that Kezia has with her boss. She works in the jewelry industry, and she works for a sort of temperamental jewelry designer in the meatpacking district who says things like she sees a homeless man with a sign, and she says that she thinks that has this idea that Sharpie should sponsor the homeless. Like, she's not a good, she's not brimming with love, but weirdly, I think they have a more equal relationship because in that relationship, they're sort of sarcastic with each other, which is how I express affection, which sometimes on the page perhaps can come off as a little more, caustic and not as friendly as I mean it to. But they also they depend on each other, and then she looks to Kezia for advice, which is something that my first boss would never do in a million years. And so for me, she became sort of this every woman and a place to put a lot of observations that I had that would go into an essay, but just didn't. I mean, that's the thing is what's funny on a granular level when you get down to it, voice is voice, right? Now I can't give them all my same voice or they would sound exactly the same. So that was a new experience, is having to actually pull back when you would observe something, but your character would not. I would see there's something, a funny way a waiter is dressed in a restaurant, and maybe in an essay I would say something, but I know that character wouldn't mention it. And as they became real and more fully formed, you sort of edit out a little bit. They're just sort of like, there's a bit in the book where she mentions, her test for whether or not she has like body dysmorphia and is worried about herself is, if she can lob a golf ball through the thighs of the woman walking ahead of her, she feels jealous. But if she could lob a tennis ball, she feels sad for that woman. And that's sort of like a kind of weird observation that I think would come from my own life. There's sort of a difference between, man, I need to work out, and ow, that looks like it hurts. So, yeah, and that's really something that I could give to her because I wasn't going to give it to the guys,
Right, yeah.
So, yeah.
Nathaniel might have the same observation.
Nathaniel's pretty body conscious and superficial,
I said Nathaniel would probably notice thigh gaps or at least have a metric.
He would certainly notice that.
For, yeah.
Thank you.
Speaking of work, we weren't really speaking of work. I'd like to talk about the work that went into this novel.
Okay. It's a lot of cheese and crying alone.
But also, you went to France.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for anyone who hasn't read the book yet, hopefully we do okay giving context with our questions. But a little bit of context for this is that on the anchor in the novel itself would be, and as a side note, my name is Yana Dimkiewicz, but I pronounce other people's names terribly wrong. So Guy de Maspont, his short story, The Necklace, is an anchor, I would say, of the clasp itself. It's not, it's a reoccurring theme essentially throughout. And for authenticity's sake, you actually traveled, you rented out a room in the chateau where guy was born in Normandy. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yes.
So you could figure out, essentially, here's a bit of a spoiler, sorry.
It's okay.
How Victor would attempt to break into said chateau.
Yeah, that was awkward.
Yeah. So awkward. There are
staying
pictures.
With people and there, yeah. Basically, you know, being like, oh, what's your security like? Yeah. Look, a croissant. Like, I've done that.
Hypothetically.
So what happens is I think that I was a little resistant, especially having written two first-person books, to writing another book that's a bunch of people sort of sitting around, especially in the greater New York area, talking about how, you know, horrible their privileged white lives are. And so I decided to, in a weird way, even though they're sort of all experiencing this inertia and all a little bit depressed, it's a comedy, yeah. That I wanted, it's a sort of wish fulfillment book, and then they all end up going on this sort of Goonies-esque treasure hunt to France. And specifically following Guy de Maupassant, who wrote The Necklace, hence the clasp. It's pretty. Yeah. Just in case, I mean, let that sink in. It's gonna, it's gonna take a whole 2 seconds. Like, you guys got it. It's fine. But I really wanted to go there and see. I mean, I feel like you don't. It's not requisite that you go to a place to write about it. Certainly, but. I had the sort of ability to, now that I didn't have my day job, to sublet my apartment and then use that money and then go to France. And so I went and I stayed with a family. And actually, the truth is, it's funny. So a big theme of the book and a big theme of the story is about social climbing and striving and going after false goals. And one interesting tidbit that they don't tell you on Guy de Maupassant's Wikipedia page, but if you read 100 billion letters that he wrote to everybody and all his biographies, he had syphilis. Anyway, if you read all that stuff, you find out that indeed he was not born in that chateau. He was born down the road in a tiny country house that was sort of in shambles, and his mother wanted a more sort of auspicious beginning for her son, so she moved the baby 2 days later to the chateau and forged the birth certificate. So he was actually not born there. But it's so fascinating to me, because then this is a man who would go on to write The Necklace, which is this very famous short story, and I make it sound even more famous than it is in the book. He would go on to write the story about, you know, a woman who, I mean, just to spoil it for you, a woman who sort of gives up everything to try to repay this debt that she accrues by losing a friend's necklace, only to run into the friend at the end of the story and be told that it was fake, and she's ruined her life for nothing. And there's similar themes in the book. And it's sort of interesting. I remember I found out that fact, and I was like, wow. So it was like wired into him at an early age. But anyway, so it was interesting to go. And I speak a little bit of French, so it wasn't that difficult. But yeah,
even further than that, I guess, on your website, there's a lovely Q&A about the clasp. And this I do have to read, so I can't look at you. I like to look at people when I'm asking questions. but you got to know Guy quite well, I'm sure you did, in addition to actually living in his not really born chateau. Yes. I'm sure you did.
He did live there, but just,
yeah,
he wasn't born.
He wasn't born. Extensive research on him, and you said he was vain, prolific, and sensitive. He was a vain, prolific, and sensitive, womanizing, egotistical genius with a... autocorrect. It says busy mustache, but actually it just... I think bushy is what you said.
It was extremely busy.
It was very busy.
There was a lot going on in his face.
Both work, yeah.
Yes.
And a foul-mouthed parrot named Jaco.
Yeah.
I was sold. So that was fascinating to me. I know that you're funny and you're humorous, but I hear some truth to this. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the relationship, or a relationship that you developed with Guy, learning all this about him and how that spoke to your writing process.
Well, it's funny. I was just talking to, you know, Lauren Groff, who wrote Fates and Furies. I think you guys featured her as well in The Riveter. You should go buy it. I was just talking to her about this, actually, because she also is a Guy fanatic and has written things that are sort of loosely based on his stories. And she mentioned, I hope this isn't revealing too much, but she mentioned, she's like, one day we have to have drinks and talk about, like, how perversely attractive he is. I'm like, I know. It's a real problem because he's terrible. It's like the ultimate bad guy that, you know, you shouldn't go for. And especially, you should never, ever sleep with him. But, like, when I said that, like, he, you know, had a parrot that he trained to talk. The thing he trained the parrot to say was to greet women by saying, "Art, hello, my little whore." Like that. Wow. I'm not going to do a full parrot voice. Keep dreaming. But yeah, and so my relationship with him actually sort of unfolded a little bit. I mean, I knew a lot about him beforehand, but not as much as I obviously knew after writing, you know, spending years thinking about this. And it unfolded sort of naturally the way it does with Victor, through Victor's eyes. Because Victor, in a lot of ways, is more the proxy for me, even though he's not gendered aligned with me. And like, for instance, Victor gets fired from a search engine, the sixth largest search engine on the internet. So it's not a company that's doing particularly well anyway. But he gets fired, and I didn't know anything. So I had a friend who had worked for Foursquare and Google, and I gave him the chapters to read where he gets fired, because I'm like, I don't know. And so he corrected certain things, like you call someone your manager and not your boss, like basic things I wouldn't know. But he gets fired for being incompetent and ignorant. So I didn't have to know that much. It worked out quite well. And similarly, the way he, in the positive version of that, is when he sort of gradually learns about Guy de Maupassant. I was sort of learning alongside him. So that sort of became my relationship with him. And then there's always... you know, there's this idea in like lots of books, and James Joyce certainly had it, Guy de Maupassant had it, a lot of short stories authors have it, where you notice this theme where the dead are perfect. Mm-hmm. You know, anyone has passed is perfect. And it's not just the impulse to not speak ill of them. It's this idea that, you know, you can have this, you sort of superimpose your own relationship on them. And so he became this sort of, like a sort of, friend, I felt, even though I don't know if I, you know, would have much use to him beyond a night or so. but I felt this sort of kinship with him. I don't know. I also like that he was kind of lost. But he also lived a very lucky life. I mean, he did go insane and try to slit his own throat. And
that was a side effect of syphilis, right?
Yeah, that was a side effect. I mean, it gets to your brain and your nose and things like that. But he also was very depressed throughout his life anyway. But having said that, he also got hit with the lucky stick, which in the fact that he was sort of aimless after the war, and his mother, you know, in an attempt to help him, wrote her childhood friend and said, "Can you help my son, give him some guidance?" And this was her next door neighbor growing up in Normandy, who was Flaubert. Like, what if you're like, my son wants to be a guitarist? I hear you know Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
It's crazy. So he's this sort of mix of tragedy and glamour that I was attracted to.
Do you guys have questions for Sloan?
The question was, did I really design a necklace? And yeah, so I thought, since the necklace in the original short story, everyone thinks it's real, it turns out to be fake. There's a necklace also in this book. There's actually two of them. One is real, one's fake. They flip-flop. It's about what's real and what's fake. And meanwhile, I have a friend who does very high-end, lovely costume jewelry. She's a great designer named Lisa Salzer, who her company is called Lulu Frost. And I approached her and I said, would you be into, just to go along with the book for fun, making a necklace that looks real but is fake based on a real book about a real story about a fake necklace? And she said, that makes total sense. And so, yes, so we co-designed it, but that's really me being very generous with myself. I think it was more me saying, like, I like the blue stone. Yeah. The question was really about the sort of decision or the dangers or the, you know, potential downsides or upsides of referencing pop culture in your writing alongside. So, you know, you have Guy and then you do have Tupac in the book as well. Not actually. There's no Tupac cameo in the book. I wish if I could go back and edit it. But, you know, how do I feel about doing that? And because it's, I assume you mean also because there's a timestamp on it to some effect. I mean, with personal essays, it's a way of, it almost feels like cheating. It actually doesn't feel like a hindrance. It feels like a way of getting at a specific generation at a specific time. So, like, I don't know how many people in this room, if I just said Jell-O 1-2-3, does anyone know what that is? Right. Okay. So, one person. Right. Because you're probably closer in my age. Where it's very, it's a way of personalizing things and a way of making things more accessible. And it's also a way of visualizing things that's sort of the work has been done for you, a little bit of the heavy lifting. You know, if you say something is like a scene in a movie and people have seen it, that's a little bit, I think you have to be judicious with it. Otherwise, you're just sort of, it's stand-up, which is slightly different than writing a narrative nonfiction essay. And then with the novel, I don't worry about it too much. The only thing because people have done it to such an extreme degree. I mean, if you look at like Bret Easton Ellis and Glamorama or something like that, the whole point of it is that is a 90s book and he just went for it. And it's just like all 90s celebrities. And, you know, but that's sort of part of the art form of that book. And it's not really part of the art form of this book. But the only thing I worried about were text things and social media things, because that changes so fast. It doesn't feel like it's trapped in amber in some other time period of your life. It actually, you know, there's a good example, but my one example really is there's a part where Nathaniel, who's a screenwriter in LA, who we've established thinks he's a gift from God, he is sort of stalking this model online and he's looking at her Facebook page and she posts a picture of her, you know, with her arm around Jack Nicholson, and he's just like completely sort of dumbstruck. But the amount of likes she had on that thing changed, because it took me, as we've established, like 4 or 5 years to write the book, and I kept editing the amount, because at first it was like, wow, 100 people have liked it, and I'm like, well, that doesn't actually seem like that many now, and then I just sort of like put it a couple, I just sort of projected out a couple of years and called it a day, and I never name it as Facebook, I never name the social media platform, but that was the biggest thing. Tech stuff, I was very hesitant, but pop culture, there'll always be somebody who appreciates it. And if they don't get it, they at least can look it up, or they can at least feel the specificity of what you're writing.
What is Jell-O-123?
Oh, yeah, that is a good question. So it's this disgusting yet kind of delicious product that came out. And I would say it is short-lived. It was short-lived. I was about to say it had a short shelf life, but I think I mean that in several ways. Where when you make it like normal Jell-O, and you put it in the refrigerator, and then it separates out for God knows what reason or what chemicals are put in to make this happen. But the bottom layer is your traditional Jell-O, and then you have a sort of moussey layer, and then the top is sort of a layer of like foam. It was delicious. It's like a poor man's parfait. Yeah, exactly. A Jell-O parfait.
Poor man's parfait.
Yeah.
What are some of the pros and cons of fiction versus essays?
I think objectively, now having done both, each have their challenges, their pros and cons. But I think, as much as it pains me to say it, because I don't want to make it sound like it's easy, but nonfiction is easier. Because at a certain point, you have... you're bouncing off the world. You have the crutch of reality to use. Whereas fiction, yes, you're using like the gestalt of your experience, but everything is your fault. Everything, every choice, every hair color, everything they do, it's just like this Jenga set that you build. And there's no part of you that can say, I don't know, I was 9. That's not, that is something that happens in nonfiction. You know, this is my impression of it. This is my memory of it, or, you know, here's my experience. And yes, you have the perspectives of these characters, which sort of then takes on the mantle of that a little bit, but it's still coming from you. You know, I mean, I think writers often talk about, the characters, you know, took over. And yes, even I just did that. But I feel like when you start talking about them, like speaking for you, like they're not, nor are they making me waffles or paying my rent. Like they're not doing anything. Like it's me. So fiction is a little bit more difficult. Fiction is a little bit more difficult. But with nonfiction, you have it's just a different set of responsibilities. You're responsible to the people you're writing about. You're responsible to the experiences. You're responsible for trying to get as close as you can to a truth that everybody knows. Which, again, I feel like if you talk about this stuff for long enough, it all blends, because I think that's what a novel is supposed to do as well. It's just a different way of getting there. So the question was, how do I sort of address the challenge or start off writing a book that's intended to be funny and I guess maintain that or do that? I mean, some of it is a little bit, this is hard because it's backing me into saying something I wouldn't normally say about myself, but some of it is my voice is a little bit the truth. Although, like I said, it's then had to splinter into three very different voices, two of which were men. But, you know, you mentioned something about, you know, the details are articulation. And once you observe, when any observation that you can make is automatically funny if you can make it in a way that no one else has made it before. And that, you know, it's the humor of recognition, the humor of we laugh because it's true. And so the kind of novel I wrote, yes. I mean, there is, like I said, there is a plot and they do go places and it's international and things happen. But it is essentially a sort of comedy of manners. And so it's meant to sort of observe or skewer or find the heart in how people talk to each other and talk about this generation where you're 10 years out of college and you're sort of on the fence of, okay, one more phone call to this person and then can we call it a day? Are we still friends? You know, and then there you have people like that in your life. And I don't think you actually, I mean, they're 30 in the book, but you could be 50, you could be 14. It doesn't matter. It's just they're at this like crossroads. And the closer, the more detailed I could get about that, the funnier it got, just because it strikes people as true. But it wasn't necessarily the goal. No, I mean, I think that, so the question was, when you work on something, you know, when you're in your little room working on something, you know, is it vulnerable? Does it feel strange to then share that with the world? It was actually 4 years, but yes, but still, it's fine. But, you know, after working on something for so long, what is it like to share it with people? Does it feel strange? It felt not strange with nonfiction because I think with most people, if you're remotely healthy and not a total narcissist, you don't think anyone is going to read your first book. And so it wasn't like I thought, oh God, now everyone's invading my space that I, you know, work so hard. I just was sort of dumbstruck by the entire thing. And also it's me. And so I think that I'm the hardest on myself in those books. And I think also I know what I can sort of take. And I feel like I'm being such a hypocrite or going back and forth on what I'm saying, because I just said, oh, I hate it when authors talk about their characters being real. And yet it did feel very strange to have people like talking about these people that I had made that are sort of like children and friends and enemies, and people were talking about them like they knew them. And I'm like, how dare you, sir? I mean, but it's an amazing compliment at the same time. So it doesn't feel invasive, you know? I mean, the same thing when you make a space, when you design something, you design it because you want people to come in and you want people to enter. But it did feel a little strange that they would sort of talk about them, and I would become strangely protective a little bit if people really casually said things about them. It's sort of like, you know, I can talk smack about my mom, but you can't talk smack about my mom. There's a little bit of that effect that happens. So yeah, but now I'm over it. But it was just when it first happened, because I'd published some pieces of short fiction like here and there, but I had never written a novel or fiction in such a grand public way before. So that was a surprise for me that's actually very true, that happens. So the question was about living in New York and it possibly being sensory overload and almost bad for writing, or as much as it inspires people, or more inspiration. Right. Well, who knows? Maybe. I've been to Edina. Edina's lovely. but no, I mean, and you were talking about, you know, musicians who have to leave. Hopefully they have to leave. I live above a guy right now who's a piano player, and I know that. And I don't want to know that. And he plays, he plays I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy. It's unbelievable. It's like a Clockwork Orange for your ears. Anyway, but so that's, yeah, so living, so the rhythm of then leaving New York is very helpful, but I think that's true for anywhere, you know? I mean, the idea of a change of scenery is not specific to New York. I mean, everybody travels and you know, does things to refresh and clear their mind. I think that for me, New York is a very convenient place. The danger for me was that temptation to make everything set there, because there's so many stories and so many ways to go. But I think it's more interesting if things are set elsewhere and you sort of take your sensibility on the road and take your characters out of their proverbial comfort zone. But yeah, I don't find it. I do have to leave occasionally. I'll go places there where I can write in huge long jags, either a writer's retreat or a friend's house, in very inconvenient times. So part of this book was written in Hudson, New York in January, where you actually can't leave the house. It's so, so bitterly cold. And then part of it was written in New Orleans in August, where also you can't leave the house. So I try to lock myself away a little bit. But then eventually, you know, wherever you go, your brain goes with you. So if you're having certain problems, not everything is going to be magically cleared up by a cabin in the woods. And not everything is going to be muddled by living in New York. So some of the things you just sort of have to figure out on your own, no matter where you are. And I don't actually find New York that. I find it mostly stimulating and not distracting. And I also feel like you should share your list of restaurant recommendations with the group. Thank you for having me, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you to you guys.